Citizen Soldiers, Disc 15.
Chapter 17. Closing to the Rhine. February 1st through March 6th, 1945. At the beginning of February, the front lines ran roughly as they had in mid-December, but behind the line, the differences were great. On December 15th, the Germans had crowded division on top of division in the Eifel, while the Americans in the Ardennes were badly spread out. On February 1st, the Americans had division piled on division in the Ardennes, while the Germans in the Eifel were badly spread out. Whatever units the Germans got out of the bulge, they sent off to plug the line somewhere else, because they felt the Americans were not likely to attack into the Eifel, which was heavier forest than the Ardennes. That, however, was exactly what Patton and Bradley wanted to do. With most of 1st and 3rd Armies already in the Ardennes, it made sense to them to attack from that area. Eisenhower did not agree. He needed 3rd Army divisions to go south to help Lieutenant Jacob Devers' forces eliminate the Colmar Pocket, and he wanted 1st Army to attack north of the Ardennes, south of Aachen, to get the Ruhr River dams, so that the U.S. 9th Army could cross the Ruhr downstream from the dams, then close to the Rhine. Montgomery's British and Canadian armies could then cross the lower Rhine with their right flank secured by the 9th Army. But when one of Eisenhower's staff officers telephoned Bradley, who was at Patton's headquarters at the time, and said Ike wanted Brad to send 4 or 5 divisions from 3rd Army south to help out at the Colmar Pocket, Bradley exploded. "We would be giving up a sure thing for a sideshow," he roared, his hand gripping the telephone so tightly that his knuckles turned white. "Go ahead and take all the divisions," he shouted. "There is more at stake than the mere moving of divisions. If you feel that way about it, then as far as I'm concerned, you can take any goddamn division and or corps in the 12th Army Group. Do with them as you see fit, and those of us that you leave back will sit on our ass until hell freezes." Bradley's final words were, "I trust you do not think I am angry, but I want to impress upon you that I am goddamn well incensed." Patton, in the background, said in a voice loud enough to be heard over the telephone, "Tell them to go to hell, and all of us will resign. I will lead the procession." As Bradley slammed down the receiver, every officer on Patton's staff rose to his feet and applauded. With tempers running so high and under that kind of pressure, Eisenhower retreated. He let Patton keep the divisions and allowed Bradley to conduct an all-out offensive into the Eifel. For the combat soldiers of ETO, that meant another month of struggling through snow or mud to attack a dug-in enemy. It would be a broad front advance with little attempt at maneuver. Its aim was to kill Germans. As an added thought, Eisenhower told Monty in explaining his plan, "The more Germans we kill west of the Rhine, the fewer there will be to meet us east of the river." He insisted on closing to the Rhine along its length, telling Monty, "We simply cannot afford the large defensive forces that would be necessary if we allow the German to hold Great Bastion sticking into our lines at the same time that we try to invade his country." That was why he insisted on eliminating the Colmar Pocket. In other words, he feared another German counteroffensive that would disrupt all his plans. That may have been excessively cautious. Monty thought it was. So did Patton. But Eisenhower had cause. One reason for his caution was the fighting quality of the German troops, supported by a steady flow of new and excellent equipment. At the end of January, he told Marshall that, "There is a noticeable and fanatical zeal on the part of nearly all German fighting men, as well as the whole nation of 85 million people, successfully united by terror from within and fear of consequences from without. He had it right and put it perfectly. The Germans knew what they had done as the conquerors and occupiers of Europe, and thus what they could expect when it was their turn to be conquered and occupied. As to terror, deserters could expect to be hanged and their families sent to concentration camps. The Nazi Party was still feared and obeyed. So long as Hitler was alive, it would be. Until then, the Germans would fight. Eisenhower preferred to fight them west of the Rhine and to close to the river from the Swiss border to Arnhem. At that point, he could pull 20 divisions out of the line to create a reserve force that would then be capable of exploiting any opportunity that came along. If we jam our head up against a concentrated defense at a selected spot, he said, we must be able to go forward elsewhere. Flexibility requires reserves. By this stage of the war, flexibility was Eisenhower's outstanding tactical quality. What he had learned in the preceding 28 months of combat was to expect to be surprised and to be ready to seize opportunities. Conditions in the February fighting were different from January, yet just as miserable in their own way. A battalion surgeon in the 90th Division described them. It was cold, but not quite cold enough to freeze, this February in 1945. Rain fell continually, and things were in a muddy mess. Most of us were mud from head to foot, unshaven, tired, and plagued by recurrent epidemic severe diarrhea. It was miserable to have to jump from one's blankets three or four times a night, hastily put on boots, run outside into the cold and rain, and wade through the mud in the dark to the straddle pit. As likely as not, the enemy would be shelling the area, and that did not help. He noted that the diarrhea was accompanied by severe abdominal cramps, vomiting, and fever. As usual, it was the infantrymen who really suffered in the nasty fighting. Cold, wetness, mud, and hunger day after day, vicious attack and counterattack, sleepless nights in muddy foxholes, and the unending rain made their life a special hell. They were hungry because much of the time supply trucks could not get to them. Between heavy army traffic and the rain, the roads were impassable. The engineers worked feverishly day and night, throwing rocks and logs into the morasses, but it was a losing battle. On February 2nd, General Patton, plagued by impossible roads, ordered dog sled teams flown in from Labrador. His idea was to use them to evacuate wounded in the snow. By the time the first team arrived, however, the snow had melted, so the dogs were never used. What was unendurable, the GIs endured. What had been true on June 6, 1944, and every day thereafter, was still true. The quickest route to the most desirable place in the world, home, led to the east. So they sucked it up and stayed with it, and were rightly proud of themselves for so doing. Private Jim Underkoffler, a former ASTP-er, was in the 104th Division. Its CO was the legendary General Terry Allen. Its nickname was the Timberwolf Division. Its motto was, "Nothing in hell will stop the Timberwolves." "That might sound corny," Underkoffler said in a 1996 interview, "but it was sort of a symbolic expression of attitude. Morale was extremely important. I mean, man alive, the conditions were often so deplorable that we had nothing else to go on but your own morale. You know, you're sitting there in a foxhole rubbing your buddy's feet, and he's rubbing yours so you don't get trench foot. That's only an example of the kind of relationship and camaraderie we had." The straight line between Aachen and Cologne ran through Düren on the east bank of the Ruhr River. But rather than going directly, Bradley ordered the main effort made with the veterans from Elsinboyne Ridge and the Battle of the Bulge, through a corridor some 17 kilometers wide, south of the dreaded Hurtgen Forest. By so doing, the Americans would arrive at the Ruhr upstream from the dams, and thus, once across the river, be free to advance over the Cologne Plain to the Rhine, without danger of controlled flooding. The first task was to get through the Siegfried Line, still a formidable obstacle, although in many places devoid of troops to utilize it. And every veteran in an ETO combat unit was well aware that this was where the Germans had stopped them in September 1944. The generals were enthusiastic for this one. General Walter Lauer, commanding the 99th Division, paid a pre-attack call on Sergeant Oakley Honey's C Company, 395th Regiment. Honey recalled that Lauer stood on the hood of a jeep, had the men gather around him, and gave a speech, saying, "We had fought the Krauts in the woods and the mountains and had beaten them. Now we were going to get a chance to fight them in the open." Honey commented, "Whoopee, everyone was overjoyed." He added sarcastically, "You could tell by the long faces." Lauer went on, "We are in for a lot of new experiences, and we are happy. Happy because we are at long last to go on the offensive." Sergeant Vernon Swanson's comment, "How can a man be happier than that?" On February 4th, C Company pushed off into the Siegfried Line. Swanson remembered that, "Our visibility was severely limited because it began snowing, and shortly the heavy winds caused the snowstorm to reach blizzard proportions. The order then came to fix bayonets." Honey recalls, "Charging into a snowstorm with fixed bayonets and the wind blowing right into our faces, after moving through the initial line of dragon's teeth, we began encountering deserted pillboxes. At one command post, out came 10 Germans with hands in the air, offering no resistance." Private Irv Mark of C Company said, "I remember taking one pillbox, and this stands out in my memory. The Krauts were waiting to surrender, and the one in charge seemingly berated us for taking so long to come and get them. He said, 'Nicht etwas zu essen,' nothing to eat. Strange we didn't feel one bit sorry for them." Swanson noted that, "None of our company can recall any direct fire during our advance through the west wall, although artillery shells dropped on us. We suffered no combat casualties, possibly because we were much smarter than we had been 6 weeks earlier, particularly about booby traps and landmines." Few companies were that lucky. Sergeant Clinton Riddle of the 82nd Airborne was in Company B, 325th Glider Infantry. At 0200 February 2nd, he accompanied the company commander on a patrol. "We walked to within sight of the dragon teeth of the Siegfried Line. We walked parallel with the line quite some distance. We could barely make out the pillbox on either side of the road that led through the dragon teeth. The teeth were laid out in 5 double rows, staggered. The Krauts had emplacements dotting the hillsides, so arranged as to cover each other with crossfire, and all zeroed in on the road where it passed through the teeth." Returning from the patrol, the captain ordered an attack. "It was cold and the snow was deep," Riddle recalled. A Company went first. It was met by small arms and mortar fire and was quickly driven to the ground. "There was more fire from the emplacements than I ever dreamed there could be," Riddle remarked, an indication of how well concealed many German fortifications were. "Men were falling in the snow all around me. That was an attack made on the belly. We crawled through most of the morning." Using standard fire and movement tactics, the Americans managed to drive the Germans beyond the ridge and over the road. "When we reached the road leading through the teeth," Riddle said, "the captain looked back over his shoulder and said, 'Come on, let's go.'
Those were the last words he ever said, because the Germans had that road covered, and when he was halfway across, he got hit right between the eyes. There was only three of us in our company still on our feet that we could account for when it was over.
Another 25 men turned up, and the new CO, a lieutenant, began employing fire and movement to attack the pillboxes on either side of the road. But the Germans had been through enough. After their CO ordered the initial resistance and then fired the shot that killed the American captain, his men shot him and prepared to surrender. So Riddle relates,
"When we reached the pillboxes, the Germans came out, calling out, 'Kamerad!' We should have shot them on the spot. They had their dress uniforms on, with their shining boots. We had been crawling in the snow, wet, cold, hungry, sleepy, tired, mad, because they had killed so many of our boys."
They were through the initial defenses of the Siegfried Line, and that was enough for the moment. The 90th Division reached the Siegfried Line at exactly the spot where the 106th Division had been hit and decimated on December 16th. Private Jack Ammon spent the night of February 5th through 6th, 1945, in a bombed-out building on the edge of the line.
"The village was eerie," he remembered. "It looked like a million ghosts of previous campaigns had passed through it."
At 0400 February 6th, the 359th Regiment of the 90th picked its way undetected through the Dragon's Teeth, minefields, barbed wire, and pillboxes in the outer ring of the fortifications. Shortly after dawn, pillboxes that had gone unnoticed came to life, pouring fire into the tanks and reinforcements following the infantry, stopping the advance. A week-long fight ensued. The Germans employed a new tactic to confound the Americans. Captain Colby explained it. "Whole platoons of infantrymen disappeared as a result of the German tactic of giving up a pillbox easily, then subjecting it to pre-sighted artillery and mortar fire, forcing the attackers inside for shelter. Then they covered the doorway with fire, surrounding the pillbox after dark and blowing it in. And the men soon learned it was safer outside the fortifications than inside." On February 9th, Regimental Chaplain Father Donald Murphy noted a variation of the tactic in his diary.
"K Company was in a pillbox. The GI outpost fell asleep, and Jerry's captured all of them, including Lieutenants Franklin and Osborne. The pillboxes are really death traps. You are helpless when you get in them."
Patton inspected a command pillbox.
"It consisted of a three-story submerged barracks with toilets, shower baths, a hospital, laundry, kitchen, storerooms, and every conceivable convenience, plus an enormous telephone installation. Electricity and heat were produced by a pair of diesel engines with generators. Yet the whole offensive capacity of this installation consisted of two machine guns operating from steel cupolas, which worked up and down by means of hydraulic lifts. As in all cases, this particular pillbox was taken by a dynamite charge against the back door. We found marks on the cupolas where 90-millimeter shells fired at a range of 200 yards had simply bounced."
To Patton, this was yet another proof of
the utter futility of fixed defenses. In war, the only sure defense is offense, and the efficiency of offense depends on the warlike souls of those conducting it.
Captain Colby gives a vivid snapshot of American artillery in action.
"We were looking at a day's assignment of about a dozen pillboxes. We were on slightly higher ground and could see them plainly. As we studied the prospect with sinking feelings, a self-propelled 155-millimeter gun clanked up to us. A lieutenant dismounted and walked over.
'I hear you could use some fire,' he said.
We did everything but hug him. We told him to pick out a pillbox and let fly.
The lieutenant pointed to a pillbox. The gunner lowered the muzzle of the howitzer, opened the gun's breech block, and peered through the barrel at the target. Satisfied with his aim, he told the loaders to stuff in a round. A 155-millimeter shell weighed 100 pounds. It took two men to put it on a carrier equipped with handles like a litter, two others to pick up the carrier and hold the shell to the chamber of the gun. A fifth man shoved it in and stuffed in the bags of gunpowder. When the breech was closed and all was ready, the gunner yanked the lanyard. The tremendous roar was, Colby said, thrilling to an infantryman. He noted that the 30-caliber bullets he was shooting were 0.3-inch in diameter, while the 155 shell was 6.1 inches. The shell struck the pillbox and covered it with a sheet of flame from the explosive charge it carried. A perfect smoke ring popped out of an air vent in the top. "Scratch one pillbox," the lieutenant said. "It is still standing," Colby retorted. "Yep, but there ain't anyone left alive inside. If there is, his brains are scrambled." Colby felt that having revealed their position, they should take cover before the Germans started their counterfire. "Aw, hell," the lieutenant said. "Let's blast some more before the fun starts. You want to fire one?" How could Colby resist? After another line of sight aim through the open bore, the gun was loaded, and Colby gave a jerk on the lanyard. Scratch another pillbox. The lieutenant told Colby to get behind the gun when it next fired, saying he could watch the shell all the way to the target. He zeroed in on another pillbox. Sure enough, when the gun fired, I could see a black dot arc swiftly toward the target. Again, there was a flash that covered the whole target. They fired a round or two at each pillbox out in front of us, then folded their equipment and clanked away to another scene. When we moved up, we found only dead or dazed men inside the pillboxes. Colby's final comment was, "No matter how many pillboxes or bunkers there might be, the fact was that man had built them and man was tearing them down. The elaborate system of dragon's teeth proved to be worthless and brought from us exclamations of amazement at the labor the Germans had expended." That point was equally true when applied to the Atlantic Wall. At the Siegfried Line in February, as at the Atlantic Wall in June 1944, the Germans got precious little return on their big investment in poured concrete. One small German investment paid big dividends. It was the shoe mine. Like the S mine, the shoe was an invention of the devil. It was simple, easily made, cheap, and deadly. The shoe mine was a wooden box the size of a box of kitchen matches. It contained a quarter pound of TNT, which looked and felt like laundry soap. When a man stepped on it, he forced a nail into a detonator, setting off an explosion that could tear off a foot or do even worse damage. There were thousands of shoe mines buried in the mud, in the fields, and in the towns along the Siegfried Line. When G Company, 328th Regiment, 26th Division, jumped off to attack that February along the Saar River south of Luxembourg, it had not gone half a block when four men stepped on mines and had to limp or hobble to the rear. The 1st Platoon set up an observation post in the battered church. Just outside, there was the body of an American soldier, but it was impossible to remove the corpse because the Germans had booby-trapped his body and placed a ring of shoe mines around him. The church was in a shambles, Lieutenant Ott recalled. The roof was gone, and there were great gaping holes in the sides. There was only one opening that we could get to on the side toward the enemy. The street was filled with shoe mines and booby traps, but the Heinies knew where they were and would slip out and toss grenades into the church. The building was so large and so strewn with rubble
that we could always hit the prone and escape being wounded. Still, Captain Seely stepped on a shoe mine and was killed. Lieutenant John Cobb, 82nd Airborne, had arrived in France on January 1st. By the end of January, he was a veteran. On February 7th, he was traveling with his platoon by truck to the village of Hurtgen. They arrived just before dark. Jumping out, Cobb had the men form up and started marching. They marched until 0100 February 8th, when they reached a village completely destroyed. Cobb found a cellar to put his platoon in, but in an hour, orders came down to move out. The task was to accompany a squad of engineers using mine detectors with the mission of clearing a trail across the Kahl River Valley. The work went slowly and consumed most of the day. The site had been the scene of a battle in November, in which a battalion of the 28th Division had taken a terrible pounding. Cobb's company was the first American unit to move back into the valley, dubbed by the 28th Death Valley. Cobb described what he saw.
Immobile tanks and trucks and the bodies of dead American soldiers were everywhere. The snow and cold had preserved the dead, and they looked so lifelike, it gave one a very eerie feeling. It was hard to believe they had been dead for 3 months. It was as if a snapshot of a deployed combat unit had been taken, with everything as it was at a given moment in the past. The forward elements with tanks and infantry, the command posts, the medical aid station, with men still lying on their stretchers, and the destroyed supply trucks were all in their proper places, just as if someone had set up a demonstration from the field manual. But the actors were all dead.
By February 8th, U.S. 9th Army, north of Aachen, had gotten through the Siegfried Line and closed to the Ruhr, but it could not risk an assault across the river so long as the Germans held the upstream dams and thus retained the capability to flood out the Ruhr Valley. 1st Army, meanwhile, was working its way through the line south of Aachen. On the 10th, 5 Corps won control of the dams, only to discover that the Germans had wrecked the discharge valves the previous evening, thus creating a steady flooding that would halt the 9th Army until the waters receded. While they waited, the GIs sent out reconnaissance patrols and practiced new techniques in river crossings. For Company K, in the center of 9th Army's front, north of Aachen, that meant sending squads at night in rubber boats over the flooding Ruhr to locate minefields and gun emplacements and to capture prisoners. Along with the other regiments in the line, engineers worked with the infantry on assault boat training and in experimenting in perfecting assault boat tactics. On February 12th, the engineers successfully demonstrated the use of assault boats, pontoons, rafts, and shooting communication wire across the river with rockets and grenade launchers. Smoke generators, first used in September 1944, were an innovation that the frontline troops greatly appreciated. While they practiced and waited for the river to drop, the men of K Company had the unusual experience of receiving visitors. "With the Ruhr as a buffer," one of them wrote, "rear echelon types who normally stayed away from the line paid us a call. First we had a correspondent, and then two colonels from 13 Corps headquarters showed up at the CP to take a look at the crossing area." Lieutenant George Pope of the 1st Platoon OP was the host. "They were middle-aged guys in their 30s, Pope remembered. "I took them up to the second floor of a building that offered a good view up and down the river." They were wearing neckties and had the chin straps buckled on their helmets. "A couple of rounds come in, little stuff, not particularly close, and these sons of bitches hit the goddamn floor. You wouldn't believe it. They said, 'Let's get out of here.' I almost broke up." D-Day was February 23rd. After dark on the 22nd, tanks drove to the river's edge.
engineers lugged the 400-pound assault boats through deep mud to forward assembly areas. Huge trailer trucks with girders and pontoons for the heavy-duty bridges ground forward to final staging areas. In the 29th Division, the men gathered beside the boats. The night was as cloudy and damp and chill as February weather can be. Many of the men had gotten soaked to the skin in wading through the waist and neck-deep water of the canals and trenches and along the banks of the flooded river. Equipment and supplies had become soaked and heavy, and in many cases, useless. The men had no way to dry themselves and were forced to huddle together in the mud and water, shivering, shaking, and praying. For the 104th Division, the objective was Durin. The obstacles between them and the town were nearly as formidable as the Channel and the Atlantic Wall had been in June 1944. The river was from 2 to 4 meters deep, 300 to 400 meters wide, with currents running more than 10 kilometers per hour. The nearest cover on the west, American side, was 300 meters inland. On the German side, the river banks were heavily mined from the river to the trench system that commanded the river. Anti-personnel mines were in the water, on the concertina wire along the river's edge, and in front of the trenches. Extensive minefields, including Schu and S mines, were throughout the depth of the German position. Conditions were similar along the whole stretch of the Ruhr. A tanker with the 84th Division noted that when the smoke generator battalion opened the valves on their huge steel canisters, vast gray clouds spread across the river, which was both reassuring and eerie. At midnight, three infantry companies made their way down the slopes toward the river, where they crouched beside their boats. We felt special kinship with these riflemen as they waited in the mud for the order to jump off. Tankers were safe behind their armor plate, and most of the support troops were in cellars or holes. But these poor bastards had no place to hide. Their attack orders read, "Pursue the enemy relentlessly to the limit of every man's endurance." At 02:45, February 23rd, the Ruhr River line, 35 kilometers long, burst into a ball of fire. It was one of the heaviest barrages of the war. Big guns, ranging from 75 millimeters to 240 millimeters, heavy and light mortars, rockets, direct fire from tanks, 50-caliber machine guns, and 40-millimeter anti-aircraft guns. Every weapon the Americans had hurled against the enemy a 45-minute deluge of bullets and high explosives designed to stun, kill, or drive him from his position. Men who were there were men who had been through many barrages. Their testimony is that this was the biggest one they ever saw. Ninth Army alone had more than 2,000 artillery pieces firing 46,000 tons of ammunition. In the middle of it all, a lieutenant in the 84th wrote, "A lone German machine gunner decided he'd had enough. He fired a long burst of tracers at his tormentors. It was his last mistake. Every tank, every anti-aircraft gun, every machine gunner within range returned the fire. Waves of tracers and flat trajectory rounds swept toward the hole, engulfing it in a single continuous explosion. We cheered lustily, and Captain George Giesel commented, 'Now, that's an awfully dead German.'" At 03:30, the first assault wave shoved their boats into the river. In the 84th, assault companies had several boats overturn, but most of the men swam to the enemy banks, though wet and cold, and many without weapons. There were only 30 rifles in one 130-man company. The engineers were able to get only three of the original 34 boats back to the west bank for the next load. The assault troops moved inland. Behind them, engineers worked feverishly to build footbridges and to get a cable ferry anchored on the far bank.
By 0830, the job was done, and ammunition, supporting weapons, and communication wire were ferried across. By 10:30, elements of the assault companies had entered Durin. Altogether, 6 divisions were involved in crossing the river. Their experience varied. Some companies found the river to be the most serious obstacle. Others got some small arms and artillery fire, and in some cases were turned back. Generally, however, the crossing went well, thanks to the artillery preparation and the smoke. By this stage of the war, the infantry-artillery coordination was one of the outstanding features of the U.S. Army in ETO. As one example, when the 104th occupied the town of Durin, the 3rd Battalion, 413th Infantry, received orders to take the insane asylum that occupied a hill and was the key feature of the area. Here was the telephone conversation between Lieutenant Colonel Edward Schinkel of the 385th Field Artillery Battalion and Lieutenant Colonel William Summers, CO of the 3rd Battalion.
"Hello, Bill, this is Eddie. When are you going to jump?"
"We'll be ready in about an hour, Eddie. Jump off at 0230.
"Okay. Here's what we will do. 1 barrage across the road, 1 on each side, and deepen. We will move the bombardment east to the end of the line of buildings at a rate of 100 yards every 3 minutes. When you reach the end of the buildings, we will put all guns on the hill for 5 minutes. How's that?"
"Okay, Eddie."
The guns opened on schedule. 48 rounds landed on the first line and were reported as accurate. The earth shook, and great clouds of red and brown dust rose from the buildings on that side of town. Sporadic enemy fire ceased in that sector. The infantry moved forward. Summers called the barrage beautiful and accurate. It went forward exactly as planned and completely neutralized enemy resistance in a vital area. By the afternoon, the engineers had a footbridge over the Ruhr. By the end of February 24th, treadway bridges were in place, allowing the tanks and artillery to join the infantry on the east bank. K Company crossed on a narrow, swaying footbridge that night. It beat swimming, but it wasn't easy. The men had 30 or 40 pounds of combat gear. Half the duck boards were underwater, and there was only a single strand of cable for a handhold. The Germans had the range and were pumping in artillery. The shooting was blind in the smoke and dark, but still close enough to be disconcerting. Sergeant George Lucht recalled his dash across the bridge.
"The Germans had regrouped, and their artillery was falling on both sides of the river, and I was thinking, boy, this is just like Hollywood."
Once over the Ruhr, there was open, relatively flat ground between the Americans and the Rhine. It was the most elementary military logic for the Germans to fall back. Why defend a plain that had no fortifications when Germany's biggest river, the Rhine, was at your back? It made no sense. Yet that is what everyone knew Hitler would do. Indeed, Eisenhower counted on it. And Hitler did. He ordered his army to stand and fight. As it had neither fixed positions nor a river line for defensive purposes, the men should utilize the villages as strong points. These were German villages inhabited by loyal Germans. When the 5th Division got into one of them, there were signs painted on the walls which said, "See Germany and die," "Onward, slaves of Moscow," and "Death will give you peace." Those signs didn't stay up long because the walls came tumbling down. The GIs used the techniques of street fighting that they had learned in the fall 1944 campaign.
"The old hands at the game go through a town keeping inside the houses," one veteran explained. "They use bazookas to knock holes in the dividing walls as they go, and when they come to the end of the block and have to cross the street to the next block, they throw out smoke first and cross over under cover of that." The most important things in street fighting were to stay off the streets and
Keep dispersed, move fast, and keep on moving whatever happens. Keep your head up and your eyes open and your legs moving. And at all costs, keep apart.
The German residents quickly came to appreciate what American firepower could do to their homes. Private Carl Drescher, a teenage German infantryman, remembered a firefight on February 25th. A German burgher crawled up to his position and told him to stop shooting, else the Americans would destroy the village.
"That tore it for me," Drescher exclaimed. "I told him he better disappear or I'd shoot him. Because we were the ones who had to fight the war that he started, not I. I was a boy when it began. I had not started it."
In the next village, a burgher suggested that he go over to such and so a hamlet to prepare his positions, as it had already been destroyed.
"I told him to get lost. We were fine where we were."
The burgher kept complaining. Drescher asked which was his house. When the burgher pointed it out, Drescher set up a mortar next to it and fired 5 quick rounds, then cleared out just before American artillery blasted the house to pieces. Replacements coming forward for the Germans were frightfully young, or alarmingly old. The old men looked for the best chance to surrender. The boys looked for a fight. Sergeant Ewald Becker of Panzer Grenadier Regiment 111 remembered a squad of youngsters that reported to him.
"I told them that the war wasn't just about them, but that it also mattered what happened to the men standing to the right and left of them. They had a difficult time understanding that it wasn't an individual effort. At the same time, they had all been in the Hitler Youth and believed in the war and our chances of winning."
Private Drescher was one of them. In one village, he and his squad found a full platoon down in a cellar.
"They all wanted to surrender to allow the front line to roll over them. We wanted to continue the war."
So did others. Captain Colby remembered a German counterattack from this period. Although the 6th SS Mountain Division had no artillery support, it launched a particularly vicious assault. Although our artillery and mortar fire was poured into the ranks of the fanatical SS men, it was ultimately rifle fire that stopped them. Some of the Germans were dropped in their tracks only a dozen feet from the American positions. Bodies of friend and foe were found literally in the same foxholes, so active was the fighting. The Germans were using with extravagance their only remaining source of defense, the bodies of their soldiers. Through February, Patton attacked. Whatever the conditions, he was at his zenith. His nervous energy, his drive, his sense of history, his concentration on details while never losing sight of the larger picture, combined to make him the preeminent American Army commander of the war. Those qualities and his professional competence. He was constantly looking for ways to improve. In early February, for example, he ordered all Sherman tanks in his army to have an additional 2.5 inches of armor plate, salvaged from wrecked tanks, put on the forward hull or glosses plate of the tanks, and was delighted with the results. For the first time, a Sherman could take a direct hit from an .88 and survive. He also had flamethrowers mounted on the tanks using the machine gun aperture, and again was delighted with the results. They were highly effective against pillboxes. Still, nothing could beat the 155-millimeter guns. According to Patton, "At 300 yards, the 155 shell will remove a pillbox for every round fired." Patton's worst enemy was the weather and what it did to the roads. On the left flank of Third Army, east of Saint-Vite, the local inhabitants watched with dismay as the tanks and trucks tore up their dirt roads, roads they did not use in the winter by law.
the nightly freezes, the daily thaws, the attempt to use them for heavy traffic, combined to make them impassable. Patton, at one point in early February, was forced to turn to pack horses to supply the front line. Still, he said, attack. Bradley wanted them to stop so that he could shift some divisions from 3rd to 1st Army.
On the 10th, Patton remembered, Bradley called up to ask me how soon I could go on the defensive. I told him I was the oldest leader in age and in combat experience in the U.S. Army and Europe, and that if I had to go on the defensive, I would ask to be relieved. He stated I owed too much to the troops and would have to stay on. I replied that a great deal was owed to me, and unless I could continue attacking, I would have to be relieved. I further suggested that it would be a good thing if some of his staff visited the front to find out how the other half lived.
On February 26th, elements of 3rd Army captured Bitburg. Patton entered the town from the south, while the fighting was still going on at the northern edge of town.
In spite of the fact that shells were falling with considerable regularity, I saw 5 Germans, 3 women and 2 men, re-roofing a house. They were not even waiting for lend-lease, as would be the case in several other countries I could mention.
Dozens of GIs made the same point. In Italy and France, the residents left the rubble in the streets, waiting for someone else to clean it up, while in Germany, the residents were cleaning up as soon as the battle passed their villages. About this time, Patton put out an order that Medal of Honor or Distinguished Service Cross winners should be kept out of the front line, because such men usually attempted to outdo themselves and got killed.
Whereas, in order to produce a virile race, such men should be kept alive.
Patton was spending 6 hours a day in an open jeep, inspecting, urging, prodding, demanding. He crossed the Sauer River on a partly submerged footbridge under a smokescreen, from which emerged another Patton legend that he had swum the river. On February 19th, when 1st Army to the north was waiting for the roar to recede, Patton wrote Bradley a letter,
saying that all the U.S. troops, except the 3rd Army, were doing nothing at all, and that while I was still attacking, I could do better with more divisions. This is the only letter I ever wrote for the record, but I felt very keenly at the time that history would criticize us for not having been more energetic.
History was very much on his mind. In the evenings, he was reading Caesar's Gallic Wars. He was especially interested in Trier, at the apex of the Saar-Moselle Triangle, on his northern flank. The historic city of the Treveri, according to Caesar, had contained the best cavalry in Gaul. As Russell Weigley puts it, Patton's passion for retracing the paths of ancient conquerors, whenever doing so could at all plausibly be combined with present strategic or tactical advantage, had caught him up. He wanted Trier. To take the city, Patton inveigled the 10th Armored Division out of Bradley and sent it to take Trier. Bradley had not intended to let Patton get the division so deeply committed.
"The tent maker," said Patton, using his nickname for Omar Bradley, "felt that we should stop attacking, and it took me and all 3 corps commanders half a day to get permission to continue the attack for another 48 hours.
Later, he commented,
"It always made me mad to have to beg for opportunities to win battles."
Lieutenant Colonel Jack Richardson, U.S. Military Academy 1935, of the 10th Armored, led a task force named for him in the attack into Trier. When he got to the Moselle River, he saw an intact bridge. He was in the leading vehicle of his battalion of armored infantry when he saw the wires leading to the demolition charges at the far end of the bridge. Jumping out of the vehicle, he raced across the bridge under heavy fire and cut the wires. Patton's comment was,
The acid test of battle brings out the pure metal.
Richardson was killed in April. Patton also noted that the piers and buttresses of the Kaiserbrücke Bridge dated back to 28 BC. Driving into the city along Caesar's Road, Patton
could smell the sweat of the legions,
imagining them marching before him into the still surviving amphitheater where the Emperor Constantine the Great had thrown his captives to the beasts. All set up by his triumph, Patton made the most extravagant claim.
Had we been refused permission to continue this attack, the whole history of the war might have been changed, because the capture of Trier was one of the turning points.
Still, he could not rest. Third Army had started the February campaign farther from the Rhine than any other army on the Western Front. At last, through the Siegfried Line, he still had so far to go to the Rhine that he feared his would be the last army to cross.
"We are in a horse race with Lieutenant General Courtney Hodges," Patton wrote his wife. "If he beats me across the Rhine, I shall be ashamed."
By the middle of the first week in March, 9th and 1st Armies were closing to the Rhine, threatening to encircle entire divisions. Hitler not only would not give permission to fall back, he ordered counterattacks. As a consequence, thousands of German troops were trapped on the West Bank, where they either surrendered or were killed. First Army intelligence declared, "Perhaps it is too early to be optimistic, but everyone feels that resistance is on the point of crumbling, and that this time we are going to the Rhine quickly without being slowed down." The following day, intelligence noted, "The Boche, although not in any sense getting up and surrendering in mass, are fighting a disorganized defensive battle. Stiff resistance where it has been encountered has been centered in the small towns, and usually after an hour or so of fighting, the soldiers have to come out with their hands up." The generals were full of drive, push, excitement, anticipation. General William Hoag, CO of Combat Command B, 9th Armored Division, typified the intense energy of the senior commanders. On March 5th, he assembled his unit commanders to give them their mission. It was to advance.
"Go around resistance, don't get in a fight. Infantry battalions will leapfrog. Bypass towns, if possible. Get help from tanks, as you can. If no AT guns, shove tanks out in front. Infantry will come on in half-tracks." But this go-go-go spirit did not reach all the way to the bottom of the command.
Sergeant Speedy Goodson, A Company, 27th Battalion, groggy from lack of sleep, wandered aimlessly into the open just as some German artillery started coming in.
"Get back under cover!" his platoon leader yelled.
"Oh, it won't make any difference, Lieutenant. They'll get us sooner or later as long as they keep sticking us out here in front."
Combat historian Ken Heckler comments, "That was the mood of most of the men as they slogged forward in the early days of March. It was cold, clammy, and rainy, sweat mixed with grime, and underwear stuck and stank. Nobody's heart was really in the fight. They kept on only because their training had made their actions mechanical, and they were so tired out, they just didn't give a damn. Then along came the needle and the whip, and they moved out again, driving toward the Rhine and a succession of objectives that seemed to stretch to infinity." The great goal, almost surely impossible, was to get a bridge. So desperate were the Americans that they used a ruse they had earlier executed dozens of Germans for using. The 83rd Division assembled a task force of German-speaking GIs, put them in German uniforms, provided them with tanks and other vehicles disguised and camouflaged to look like German models. The task force set out after dark, March 2nd, talked its way through the German lines, and at dawn reached the Rhine at Oberkassel. a German sentry challenged the column. A firefight broke out. The task force was strong enough to fight its way to the bridge, but the noise of battle alarmed the town's air raid warden, and he set off the alarm. The German engineers at the bridge took that as the signal to blow it, just as the American tanks were rolling up. Cologne was a magnet for First Army. The famous cathedral city was the fourth largest in Germany, and the biggest on the Rhine. The Germans had never imagined invaders from the west would get that far, so Cologne was defended only by a weak outer ring of defenses, manned by bits and pieces of a hodgepodge of divisions, and a weaker inner ring manned by police, firemen, and Volkssturm troops. Such forces could not long hold up an American army that was at the peak of its power. The Americans were pouring through the Siegfried Line. The Germans were standing and fighting as best they could. American columns were advancing 15 kilometers a day and more, encircling German divisions, forcing a surrender. Meanwhile, the artillery was pounding the cities and bridges. Major Max Lale, 401st Field Artillery, wrote his wife on March 2nd, "I have often read that an army on the move is a happier army than one which sits, and now I can believe it. I saw a bed of pansy blooms. Tonight, just at dusk, I stood from a long distance away and watched the plumes of smoke, the flashes of flames, and listened to the long, low rumble that marked the death of one of the oldest cities in Europe." On March 5th, General Maurice Rose's 3rd Armored Division entered the city, followed later that day by Terry Allen's 104th Division. The next day, Rose's tanks reached the Hohenzollern Bridge, but predictably most of the structure was resting in the water, as were the other Cologne bridges over the Rhine. In Cologne, only the great cathedral stood, damaged but majestic. Like St. Paul's in London, it had been used as an aiming point, but was never knocked down. Critics of the air forces said it survived because it was the target. Others claimed it, like St. Paul's, was spared by divine intervention. Still others said it was a tribute to the magnificent workmanship of medieval cathedral builders. It was carnival time. Mardi Gras came on Tuesday, March 7th. In Cologne, one of the most Catholic of German cities, the inhabitants did their best to celebrate. Lieutenant Gunther Materna, a German artillery officer, recalled that his men spotted a ship tied to a wharf, investigated, and found it filled with champagne and still wines. They proceeded to have a party. People emerged from their cellars to join in.
"And so we had a great time," Materna said. "We got drunk. People came up to me and said, 'Take off your uniform. I'll give you some civilian clothes. The war is already lost.'"
But Materna, although drunk, spurned the temptation, and the next day, badly hungover, managed to get across the Rhine in a rowboat. He was one of the last Germans to escape. Hitler's decision to defend the Cologne Plain and the rest of the country between the Siegfried Line and the Rhine had cost Germany heavily. The Americans had taken 250,000 prisoners and killed or wounded almost as many. More than 20 divisions had been effectively destroyed. The Allied air forces were by now taking full advantage of the lengthening days and better weather, blasting every German who moved during daylight hours, flying as many as 11,000 sorties in one day. Sergeant Becker, in a Tiger tank, knew what that meant.
"The Americans attacked from all directions at once, from above, below, sideways."
On the first day of World War II, then-Colonel Eisenhower had written his brother Milton, "Hitler should beware the fury of an aroused democracy." Now that fury was making itself manifest on the west bank of the Rhine River. The Allies had brought the war home to Germany. Now it was German villages that lay in ruins as the front lines passed. A group of men from the 101st got into Cologne a couple of weeks after the occupation of the city. They were impressed by the extent of the destruction. Every window shattered, every church hit, every side street blocked with rubble. The giant statue of Bismarck on a horse was still standing, but Bismarck's sword, pointing toward France, had been cut off by flying shrapnel. The paratroopers wandered to the river, where they began pointing and laughing at the grotesque ruins of the Hängebrücke, or suspension bridge. An elderly German couple stood beside them. The Germans began to cry and shake their heads. All their beautiful bridges had been twisted and mangled, and here were American boys laughing. Many of the GIs were glad enough to see German villages and cities in ruins. In World War I, Germany had escaped destruction. It was Germany's turn this time. Bring this war home to the Germans, and they won't be starting another one anytime soon, was the feeling. What bothered them more than German bridges blown up by the German army was the fact that they were there, on the front lines, with hard fighting ahead. In some cases, they had been there since June 6, 1944. It should have been someone else's turn. Something more bothered them. Private David Webster of the 101st spoke directly to it. On February 15th, a buddy had died a particularly gruesome death. Webster wrote, "He wasn't 20 years old. He hadn't begun to live. Shrieking and moaning, he gave up his life on a stretcher. Back in America, the standard of living continued to rise. Back in America, the racetracks were booming. The nightclubs were making record profits. Miami Beach was so crowded you couldn't get a room anywhere. Few people seemed to care. Hell, this was a boom. This was prosperity. This was the way to fight a war. We wondered if the people would ever know what it cost the soldiers in terror, bloodshed, and hideous, agonizing deaths to win the war. God, I hate the Germans," Eisenhower once wrote Mamie. In the first years of the war, he had hated them for making aggressive war and for all the misery they brought to the countries they overran. By 1945, when most of the Nazi Empire had been liberated by the Allies, he hated them for forcing him to destroy their cities and kill their young men, for making him order young Americans into battle, for fighting for a cause that wasn't just hopeless and evil, but directly contrary to the best interest of the German nation. But it had to be done. Chapter 18. Crossing the Rhine. March 7th through 31st, 1945. The Rhine was by far the most formidable of the rivers the GIs had to cross. It rises in the Alps and flows generally north to Arnhem, where it makes a sharp turn to the west. It was between 200 and 500 meters wide, swift and turbulent, with great whirlpools and eddies, 2 to 3 meters deep. The Germans on the far bank were disorganized and demoralized, dismayed by their losses in the insanity of trying to fight it out on the Cologne Plain, but still determined and capable of utilizing the natural advantages the Rhine gave them to defend their country. Those advantages included the scarcity of suitable crossing sites. There were only 2 or 3 places from Cologne south that were even possible. Worse, along that stretch, there were no major objectives on the east bank or inland for some 50 kilometers, and the hinterland was unsuitable for offensive warfare. The terrain was heavily wooded, undulating, and broken in many places by narrow valleys. The roads twisted and turned, rose and fell, as in the Ardennes. North of Cologne, Montgomery's 21st Army Group had many suitable crossing sites, good terrain for a mobile offensive, and major objectives just across the Rhine in the Ruhr Valley. Beyond the Ruhr, the North German plain led straight to Berlin. So while Eisenhower's heart was with Bradley, Hodges, and Patton, his mind was up north with Monty. General Harold Pinky Bull, Schaeff G3, and his planners had decided that up north was the right place for the main crossing. Eisenhower agreed, but warned that the possibility of failure cannot be overlooked. I am therefore making logistic preparations which will enable me to switch my main effort from the north to the south, should this be forced upon me. To the north, Montgomery's armies were closing to the river. As they did, he began to build his supply base for the assault crossing and exploitation that would follow. Altogether, he required 250,000 tons of supplies for the British and Canadian forces and the U.S. 9th Army and 17th Airborne Division. 9th Army had been part of 21st Army Group since the preceding fall. The 17th Airborne Division had arrived in Europe in December and had been thrown immediately into the Battle of the Bulge. It had combat experience, but had not made a combat jump, and was currently making practice jumps in Belgium. Montgomery's staff had begun planning for the Rhine crossing back in October 1944, as soon as it was evident that Market Garden had failed. The final plan was almost as elaborate as for Overlord, the scope almost as big. 80,000 men, slightly less than half the number of men who went into France on June 6, 1944, would cross the Rhine by boat or transport airplane on the first day for Operations Plunder, the crossing by boat, and Varsity, the airborne phase, with an immediate follow-up force of 250,000 and an ultimate force of 1,000,000. As usual, Montgomery proceeded with what Weigley has characterized as the majestic deliberation of a pachyderm. He set D-Day for March 24th. For the 2 weeks preceding the assault, he laid down a massive smoke screen that concealed the buildup and gave the Germans ample warning about where he was going to cross. He gathered 600 rounds of ammunition per artillery piece. Beginning March 11th, the air forces pounded the Germans on the east bank, hitting them with 50,000 tons of bombs. Monty invited Churchill and many other dignitaries to join him to watch the big show.
This ends Disc 15.